this? This is tape number 4 of the morning job on November the 11th.
Now, Mr. President, one of the important areas of discussion is the power of the presidency in terms of your appraisal of it. Does the Constitution provide enough elbow room for a president to exercise all the power he should to be effective, or does he need more?
Well, if a president wants to meet a situation, he can always find a way to do it. And the Constitution provides the powers of the president in a way so that under nearly every circumstance, he can meet any crisis with which the country is faced.
Does he have enough power to act on his own in view of the times in which we now live without being slowed up considerably by enabling things he has to get from the Congress?
Well, that may be the truth, but if he's a leader, he can always get the Congress to do what's necessary to meet the situation. Well, I've been through that, and I know.
Excuse me, Mr. President. Is a president always in a position to be master and leader in a situation in the country? In other words, aren't there other factors besides the president? You're emphasizing the importance of the presidency.
That's right. Well, the president, when he has to meet a situation, has to look it over, and then he wants to get all the information he possibly can and see how much help he can get to help him put it over. And if he gets the right sort of help, he can always get it put over.
That's right, but I mean, Mr. President, isn't the president often carried along by other forces over which he can't possibly have any control?
If he's a weak man, that's the case. If he isn't, he can make the conditions meet the situation which he has to meet. But getting the people who really count to go along with him, and reasonable men will always go along with a man when he's got the right idea and leadership.
What do you mean by people who really count?
The Congress and the country as a whole.
Well, everybody counts, but how are there more people that count for more than others?
Oh, yes, there always are. Every community has a leader. And if you can get the leaders in all those communities, the leaders in the Congress, you don't have any serious trouble. And they're not hard to get when you're right.
You think you get the people automatically if you get their leaders?
That's right. They're always looking to somebody to tell them what to do because they're lazy. They don't like to think for themselves.
Now, Mr. President, you have had enough experience with labor leaders to know that the leaders can try to lead politically, but their members don't follow them politically.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
And farmers do.
You want to be careful about that because you want to reach the people behind the leaders and behind the farmers when you go to work on a thing that's international in its scope, or national either, for that matter.
What I'm trying to get at, Mr. President, is can you actually write a history of a country starting only from the White House?
No. You've got to start from the grassroots.
In other words, there are other factors besides the man in the White
House. Correct. That's absolutely correct.
All right. Shut
it off. I've got to go take a leak.
Just want to get back to sort of challenge the theory for the sake of evoking your philosophy.
That's all right.
About emphasis on American history, on the presidency. Wouldn't it be just as important to write a history from the point of view of what Congress did or what the economic factors were? You still feel that the president plays such an important role in modifying all these forces?
Well, I think it'd be the finest thing in the world if an approach could be made from both the legislative branch and the judicial branch, along with what we're trying to do on the executive branch. I think a parallel history of what's happened along that line would be of very great interest to the welfare of the country and the youngsters who are growing up.
I understand that, Mr. President, but your feeling is that the role of the president is the preponderant role in the history of the country.
It's a primary role, of course, because every period is reckoned
on the history of the administration of the man who was the chief executive in the White House. And that's customary.
Well, you take the position that the country vests its power in its elected officials. Now, what does it do when it has president of one party and the Congress of another party? What is the public? How do you interpret that as an action by the public? We've just had it. We've had it before.
Well, it's part of the American people's idea that they think when a fellow has reached the top peak, the time has come for him to pull him down. And that's what they usually do. And that's part of the game. In 1946, they elected a Republican Congress, and I had a lot of fun with it. In fact, I used that Republican Congress to be reelected in 1948. And the same situation has developed now. Eisenhower, who was elected because of his military background and the halo which he wore, in 1956 and 1958 had a Congress that are opposed to him because the people didn't want him to have too much power. That's what was behind it.
You feel that that was the major intent?
Yes, because he didn't have any program, never made any effort to put forward the leadership to which he was entitled. If he'd done that, then he would have had no difficulty whatever.
Or maybe you feel, this is just a thought here, Bill, maybe you feel that people were anticipating that he would be more a very impressive figurehead of the head of the government, but the business of the country had to be conducted by the Congress during his administration.
And they found out that it couldn't be done. The executive has to conduct the business of the country.
That's the point.
What you're saying, Mr. President, is that a man not only has to be a personality to be a president, but unless he has a program, his personality doesn't succeed in
that. That's right. He's got to have a program. And he's got to have the guts and the ability to put it over.
In other words, he's got to be a doctrinaire as well as a
whatever
politician.
That word means, he has to be.
All right. That's a good commie word. That's a bad commie word.
No, it isn't. I know what Bill means, yes. But then what we've got to do is to have leadership. And that leadership has to have a program. And the leadership in the government of the United States is always centered in the president. His administration.
All right. Now, if the president then is vested with the power of leadership, then why is it that Congress continually balks at it, and why all presidents have so much trouble with Congress when he wants them to do things
well,
they don't want to do?
That's the way it ought to be. That's the way it ought to be. That's the check and balance thing which you have, so that no president can be a dictator. If he has a good program and the proper leadership, he can get his program over. But the Congress is elected in sections of the country, in the House of Representatives and in the states, in the case of the senators. And they represent viewpoints of their home setup. And the president is supposed to represent the whole country. And if he doesn't, he can't have any luck with Congress. If he does, he can get anything he wants from Congress.
Well, don't you think that Congress, no matter how obstreperous it might get, is no impediment to an actual leader as a president?
No, I don't think it is. And I think that if the president understands the political setup of the country and its understanding of the congressmen and their background and what their troubles are at home, he doesn't have any trouble getting his program over.
Well, this insurance against a possible dictatorship by a president makes the Congress a pretty expensive price to pay sometimes. From Washington and on down, we've had trouble with
it. Well, yes, it's all right. It's all right. We're still a republic. We're still going good. And if it hadn't been for that situation, we wouldn't have been. If we had a democracy where we'd be in a terrible situation, with the setup which we have, by the people of the United States, and the Congress elected in, and by states in the Senate, situation that is unprecedented in the history of the world government, in the history of the world government, British government, the history of the world, British government, the history of the world.
And you expect the function of the Congress as a possible runaway president.
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. It happened with Roosevelt his first 2 years. After 32, he could get anything he wanted. So.
And you think that was a good thing? Well, you think that was a good thing?
Well, of course it was. Of course it was. Well, even had a dictator if that hadn't been the case. Dictator if that hadn't been the case. Dictator if that hadn't been the case.
Even if you have a coalition, even if you have a minority that prevents the president from carrying through some of the progressive programs.
That's the kind of a setup we have, and that's the reason for it.
And these men from these chairmen of committees from the South that have been standing in the way and thwarting a lot of
It depends on what your viewpoint is, whether they've been standing in the way or not. They've been against certain things. Eventually, when they were wrong, they were overruled eventually.
Well, they were against your viewpoint. They were against President Roosevelt's viewpoint.
That's right. But we still got the things that were necessary for the welfare and benefit of the country.
Well, what you're saying, Mr. President, is that...
we got a problem here.
I agree. Yeah. That's the one thing that happened.
All right.
What you're saying is that a man who's in the White House has to be more than an administrator. That he always has to face the question of whether going ahead in certain fields of government activity or just to stand still.
Always got to be in the frame of mind to go ahead. He's got to be a public relations man who understands what may happen in the future. And he's got to use that ability as a public relations man to get the Congress to do what he thinks is best for what's to come. Anybody can figure out what ought to happen after it's passed, but it's somebody who has to think about the future, and that's the president's job.
Well, you're saying something important by saying that a president always has to go ahead.
That's right. He always has to go ahead.
And you don't conceive of any president who ought to sit and just let things go.
No. He's got to have ideas. He's got to present those ideas. And if those ideas, the welfare and benefit of the country, in the long run, he'll get them over. He might have to get them over in the first session of Congress. He might be able to get them over in the second session of the Congress. But if he's always looking to the future for the welfare and benefit of the country based on the historical past.
In other words, it's just more than an administrator or a caretaker to have
That's
the government
right.
function efficiently.
He's got to be a leader, and he's got to be looking to the future all the time.
And a creator of ideas.
That's the point, exactly.
I still come back to the point that a president who has a program that the people, the majority of the people want, and the majority of the people in the states want, and still these men who are chairmen of committees in the House and the Senate who've been there all those years and who just will not have it, isn't that an assumption of authority that makes a president's position not only difficult, but in need of solution? How does he go about overcoming a few people to say no?
Well, of course, you're right on that. There are certain chairmen of committees in the Congress whose objective is to hamper a program
that any president wants to put over. But the president, if he has the right sort of a program and keeps telling the country that this is the program that we ought to have, those chairmen in the long run can't obstruct what's necessary and right in a legislative way. Now, if you remember, one of the greatest mistakes a president can make is try to go out in various states and try to force the election of people, that the people don't want. You can't do that. There's no purge in the government of the United States.
End of tape for morning, November 11th. This is the beginning of tape 5, the morning of November the 11th. We were just talking about how the president overcomes the obstruction of committee chairmen in the Congress.
But in the main, I think the president was trying to say that these are difficult situations for any president to live with, but it's a high price, but not too high a price to sustain the checks and balances of our system.
That's right, to maintain free government so that there's no chance for a dictatorship. Now, the president is supposed to be the best public relations man in the country when he's president of the United States. He's supposed to have friendly relations with all the members of the various committees in the Congress, particularly when that Congress belongs to his party. And sometimes those members of those chairmen of those various committees in the House and the Senate are not in favor of his program. What he must do is to get those people with him, discuss the matter, and then if they don't go along, then he's got to go on these, under Roosevelt was called fireside chats under my administration, Republic statements on this situation, and see if he can't convince all the people without making any attempt to purge anybody that he is right and that his program ought to go over without in any way reflecting on anybody who is in the other branch of the government by making it appear that they're no good and all that kind of business. He's got to convince them that they are wrong in their approach to the thing and convince them also that they ought to go along for the welfare and benefit of the people. In the long run, he can get it done.
Well, Mr. President, it strikes me that this is your very special philosophy and contribution to the observation of what happens. You don't know of any president previous to your time that expressed himself the way you did.
Well, no, they haven't expressed themselves, but by action, you can name a number of them that were able to get along in that line. Wilson was one. Franklin Roosevelt was one. When he got his ears knocked down when he was trying to purge some congressmen, he found that that wasn't the way to go about it. And you'll find, if you read the history of the country very carefully, that those men who succeeded in getting their programs over, and I named James K. Polk, who was only in the White House 4 years. He got his whole program over. He'd been Speaker of the House. He knew all the members of the House and the Senate. And when it came time to put his program over, he talked to them and they listened to him. And that's all it takes. It's a public relations proposition. When I was in a very, very serious situation with regard to the Greek and Turkish program, with regard to the Marshall Plan, the rehabilitation of those countries in Europe, I called in all the members of the committees, the minority and the majority leaders of those committees, and discussed the matter with them, and I never had one bit of trouble. And I told Sam Rayburn and all the members of the committees, that is the chairman and the minority leaders of these committees, that we would have to spend $17.4 billion to put this into effect over a 4-year period. They were surprised, but I explained the situation to them. They went along. We got it put over, and that's all there was to it.
We want to do a complete piece on that. But when the for the record here, when you refer to public relations people, that's become slightly tinged with a negative now, because every special privilege outfit and every little high-pressure group has now got a public relations man. The government's supposed to have only public information people, but nobody has public educational persuasion people, and you were more or less persuading the American people the point of view, or at least informing them about
all that I consider is a definition of this public relations that I'm talking about. It's a man who has a program which he thinks, and this is in a political situation where he's the head of a government or some of that kind, who thinks he has a program that's worthwhile. And then, in order to get that program over, he must get the people who have control of the finances, who have control of the policies in the legislative branch of the government, and convince them that his idea is the right one. That's National Public Relations Organization. And unless he can do that, he can't get his program over. And that's all there is to it.
Well, you prove that you could do that with a with an opposition party. But of course, this party business now that we're going to discuss with you in one of these things is becoming a little difficult too, because it's not along party lines anymore that the president has his biggest troubles. He has them among the conservatives and the so-called progressives.
Well, if he's a leader, he can get them all together and make them believe in what he's got to do.
Well, he cannot invoke party discipline anymore, can he not?
Well, they never did have any party discipline in this country like they have in Britain and other places. It isn't a case of party discipline. It's a case of getting the people who are in the party to behave themselves so they can go back home and be elected. And if he's smart, he'd go back home and see that they are elected.
Now, we'll talk a little bit more about that, Mr. President. Party discipline is such an important subject.
It is an important subject, and party discipline is a matter of the feeling of the member of the party. We don't have any whip or anything to hold over a man's head if he's a member of a party. Although, if he deserts his party, it can be made very difficult for him to be reelected when he goes back home. And we don't want to have any hammers or any idea of holding a man's feet to the fire to get him to do what's right. If you can convince the members of the people in his district, that he hasn't done what's right, you don't have any trouble with him anymore. I know various instances where that's happened.
Well, in other words, you feel that once the public is informed of the necessity, it isn't a problem with party discipline or party organization. The party then will follow the leadership of whoever is president, because that is the party in control anyway.
That's right. The president's got to be the head of his party. He's got to know how to convince that party that he's carrying out the program in which the vast majority of them are interested. If he does that, then you don't have any difficulty. But there isn't any hammer that you can put on people. Whenever a man commences to try to put on a hammer, as Roosevelt proved to his own satisfaction when he was trying to purge some of the people in the Democratic Party, the thing that is necessary to do is for the leader of the party, and that's the President of the United States, to be careful to see that the people in the party understand what he's trying to do, and if it's right, they'll go along with him, and then the leaders and the obstructionists will have to get in line with him. And you don't have to use any hammer to do that.
Well, yet, just to add a little controversy here, you did use a bit of a hammer in 48 on the civil rights thing on the South. Now, you risked the...
Yes, but then that is a different matter.
Why was that?
The South was not wholly lined up with the policies of the party. And then we had to take whatever action was necessary to meet the situation. And that was an organized situation and not a party affair. It was an organized situation within the party, which wasn't wrong, and we had to overcome it.
In other words, this was...
Which was wrong, and we had to overcome it.
It was not a matter of discipline that you were invoking.
No.
What you were invoking were principles.
It was a matter of principle to meet a situation which you'd agree to carry out. That's all there was to it.
Well, in other words, you were carrying out the policy of the platform of the party adopted at its convention when you ran for president again.
That's right.
But
in
you
1948.
But you then were more or less carrying through the party of your predecessor, or the pronouncement of your predecessor, which never got quite put into practice, and you wanted to put into practice some of the representations of the preceding administration.
On which platform I had been elected in 1944 as vice president and had gone all over the country stating my support of that platform, and I supported it after I was in the place where I didn't have to support it if I didn't want to.
Why was that? How could you disown a platform on which you ran?
Well, it's been done. It's been done. I couldn't disown it because I'd helped to write it, and I was interested in it and helped put it over.
What you were suggesting, you might ignore it, disown it.
You could ignore it, not try to carry it out, but I didn't. I carried it through.
Is that a platform absolutely binding as a contractual obligation that the people, the writers of the platform make with the people, who's 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 of the platform make with the people,
who's
of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people,
who's
of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people,
who's
of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people,
who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the platform make with the people, who's of the plat as any morals, he ought to carry it out. He doesn't have to do it. Every American is free and independent, more independent than anybody else. But if he believes in principles and believes in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any other party on whose platform he's elected, then he must do his best to carry it out.
What if he has misgivings or second thoughts on the subject?
He ought to get off the ticket if he has that.
After he becomes president, he has misgivings or the
Well, we've had them like that, and it's too bad. Doesn't happen.
I would like to just cast your mind back in a reflective mood again. You came out of no mold that was any resemblance to any other president. You came out of a mold of your own. And yet, because of your knowledge of history, you had always had contact with history and your predecessors. Which one of the presidents kept recurring to your mind as you were functioning as president, if at all?
Jefferson, Jackson, and Woodrow Wilson.
Three of them.
That's
and
it.
In all of your actions and all of your interpretations, those three...
I was interested in what those three had done under circumstances which could be parallel with what we were faced. But on a fellow in modern times becomes the chief executive, it's his business to find out the relationship of the things with which he's faced in connection with what's gone before, and then to try to project what he has to do into the future and see whether they're example is one to be followed or whether he has to set an example of his own. And every president has to act on his own, no matter what the situation may have been before. But he has to have that background to be sure that he's doing what's right.
Now, there's always a great deal of unfinished business when a president leaves office.
That's right.
What was the most troublesome bit of unfinished business to you when you took leave of that office to turn it over to your successor?
Oh, well, there were several things pending that needed to be taken care of. International relations were the things I was most interested in. The establishment and the carrying through of the operations of the United Nations, our association with our friends down south, the Inter-American Organization, and our setup for the defense against the programs of the communists to take over the free world. And that was the setup of the European allies. And I was very much afraid that perhaps those things would not be effectively carried through. Well, it's been proven that they weren't when they forgot that the Monroe Doctrine existed and allowed the communists to come into Cuba. And when they let the foreign flag fly over the Panama Canal, and when they didn't protect the British and the French in the Suez Canal, which was a most disastrous thing so far as the welfare of the world is concerned. And that's about all. I was thinking about those things all the time, but then one didn't use for my thinking any further for the simple reason that we had a new president.
Just one thought here. In light of this disappointment that you now experience, do you regret not having run for re-election in 52?
No, I do not. I do not regret. I thought I'd done my duty, and I've been in politics 40 years. Been in public office in the national capital for 18 years, and I thought that was enough.
We're just getting good here now.
That's the end of tape 5, the morning of November the 11th.
Don't put on another one. Go ahead.